Do you know how powerful you are? Welcome to Rise Urban Nation.
Welcome everybody to Rise Urban Nation.
Reshaping and elevating your mindset to help you achieve what you believe.
Sometimes we don't even see our own greatness. You can't be what you can't see.
And connecting Black cultures to build a community of talent and success.
Black people need to realize that they are assets. You are an asset.
When we rise, you rise.
Come together as a group.
This is Rise Urban Nation with Terrell Simmons.
Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Rise Urban Nation. It's your host, Terrell Simmons, and I have the privilege of just being shocked, resounded, amazed, and just educated by all of the different amazing projects and so forth that are going on out in the venture capitalist space. And the next guest that I have, or I should say the next two guests that I have coming to you, is one of those stories that I've got to really learn more about, Resilient Ventures, which is a dynamic duo. And this is the first time on the show that we will, you know, get to have Keith and our dear brother Tom, who's an ally, of course, supporting this mission of just transforming the venture capitalist space. They have an incredible story. You know, Keith Daniel, or I should say Reverend Dr. Keith Daniel, he's a co-founder and managing director of Resilient Ventures LLC, and he's just committed to capital fund investing in African-American-led high-growth companies. And he and his partner Tom, who have a very unique story of how they got together. You know, Tom in his 60s, he called that his most productive years. You know, he was together with his partner able to raise $3.5 million committed capital investment fund to really create and disrupt the disparities in access and opportunity for African-American entrepreneurs. And I just love their story, love what they're doing together. And without further ado, let me bring both of them to just tell their amazing story and what they've been able to create. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Rise Urban Nation. It's your host, and I am here today with two amazing gentlemen, Thomas and Keith. When Thomas came on, sometimes in this work, this great work that we do, you need allies. So he is our brother from another mother, but he is along right side with us in the fight for equity and just amplifying the work of Blacks and Pan-Africans everywhere. So we're going to get into the episode. We're going to dive right in and hear about their journey, their stories, and the amazing work that they're doing at Resilient Venture. Wait, did I say that correctly? Was it Resilient?
Yes, you did.
Resilient Ventures. And I know there's probably a story behind that name. How did you guys come up with that name? Let's start there.
Yeah. Well, my journey has started in the 90s, but sort of about 8 years ago, I was in a more intensive racial equity training course, mm-hmm. where I was learning about the history and racial equity and the whole conversation. And about midway through the 2 days, the facilitator asked every person in the room, there was about 70 people there, to give a word to their identity. Mm. And I noticed, it was interesting that several African-American people had stood up and said resilient. Mm-hmm. And I'd never heard that word used to describe an identity. And it caused me to think, you know, and then I went to the biological definition, which has a specific meaning. It's the ability of an organism to withstand constant environmental stress and hardship and still flourish, like anything that lives on a coral reef, for instance, that's constantly pounded by the waves. Mm. So that, you know, I think that we teach in our own racial equity material, the idea of privilege being a tailwind and what African-Americans experience as a headwind. And that, so that all worked together with resilient. I thought it would be a good word that would say, hey, look, we're using a word that means something to the community. And so sign up or apply, please.
I love that. Now, Keith, I loved your story because me and Keith got a chance to connect real quick before we hit the record button. Now, tell me about your a little bit of background knowledge on you and then your journey into this space.
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having us on the show, Terrell. I'm really, always grateful. We need to inspire each other. I tell Tom a lot, when you walk into spaces and you're one of few, there's that little bit of that sort of feeling like, oh, I've kind of arrived. But then you have that kind of get out moment where it's like, I'm not sure I should be here, or want to be here. And so it has been a journey for me growing up in Washington, D.C., parents from the South, having migrated up to the North to get better jobs and careers in the government, and then coming to school in the South at Duke University. I always felt like I belonged. Durham is a legacy city, Durham, North Carolina, where we are and where my parents are from. Again, sometimes when you're a kid, you don't realize the greatness that you're around until you look back and say, yeah, my mom and dad, they were some bad folk, If they could have had the rights to own or to start their own businesses, my mom was an equal opportunity employment director for like 30 years for the Department of Navy and Agriculture. My father worked for a defense contractor. He was a drafting engineer. And, they were career service civil servants. And they wanted something certainly better for me. And I know maybe my family was proud for me to be one of the first of my family to attend a PWI, predominantly white institution or historically white institution. And so I learned the importance of my community. And my high school was predominantly Black, all my neighborhood and my church. And so going to a place like Duke and seeing the world sort of open up in terms of networks and people, different countries, that was all so valuable to me. And then I ended up working for the university for full-time in higher education. Went back and got my graduate degree at NC State University in higher ed.
Congrats.
And then as I continued to progress through life, I realized my values were centered more around my faith. Mm-hmm. So I took an educational leave from working in human resources at Duke and went to Duke Divinity School. Mm-hmm. And I still have a teaching role there, but my life is pretty much primarily around the work of theology, the work of trying to figure out the mysteries of life and purpose and, how do we fulfill something higher than ourselves in the world. And so most of my brain is in that kind of space, but the education space, continuous learning to me, always having a book in my hand, always looking for new things to read, just that curiosity has driven me significantly. Last thing I'll say, I ran a summer institute at the Fuqua School of Business for rising high school seniors from the mid-90s up until 2020. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like my recess, to be around young people, exposing them to opportunities through corporate America, private enterprise, entrepreneurship, just gave me a lot of fun in the summer times. Mm-hmm. So doing what I do today is kind of like, I was kind of telling young people, hey, there's a world out there that you can make a lot of money, you could be successful. You just got to figure out how to do it and go find some people who are going to give you the money. And now I get to kind of, I guess, practice what I was preaching to them. So
that's a beautiful story. Me and you have so many parallels in our life. I grew up in DC. I got family in North Carolina. I'm in a career in HR right now. And I also have some ties to learning about entrepreneurship and the angel investment world due to some equity, diversity, inclusion initiatives from Google and tech startups and I was like, man, I guess we were just destined to meet at some point.
Yeah, all the way across the what we say, East Coast, West Coast.
So tell me, how did you two meet? Like how did that interaction happen? And then how did the forming of what you guys created together come to be?
Yeah, our job in Tom, we have a mutual friend, a family that happened to be African American. They went to do some mission work abroad in Romania. And Tom knew this family probably before we did, although they've been a part of our lives for 30 something years as well. Mm-hmm. And we just admired their journey and their desire to see a difference in the Black community in particular. Mm-hmm. And when they came back from Romania, they asked us to be on an advisory board as they were thinking through, well, we're going to resettle back in the U.S. We're going to come back to Durham. And we want to be focused on the marginalized community in Durham. We want to do this right. We want to do this well. Mm-hmm. Actually, they were teaching us some things about asset-based community development. Stop looking at communities that have been marginalized and categorized as if it was there's some insufficiency there. There are assets there. You know, there are there's talent there. They you know, our communities historically knew how to survive ourselves in the country, in this country. So we did some reading groups with them. There's actually a book called The Disintegration of Black America that was really thoughtful. You might enjoy it. I know, Terrell, you know this book, but it talks about the Caribbean community, you know, African-American poor community, the celebrity community that, you know, kind of the rich and famous African-Americans that sort of, you know, we have, and how how segregated we essentially are in the breaking down of that fabric from a time where you lived in the neighborhood and the lawyer was next door to the you know, the housekeepers and your Sunday school teachers. And we were kind of compacted in that space that, you know, when you look back historically, you say, well, how much we lost when integration happened, right? When some of us were able to sort of make it, you know, the whole good times, I mean, good times versus the Jeffersons, you know, that dynamic. So, but Tom and I got acquainted through working with these friends. And then Tom showed up at my church one day when the topic was on racial reconciliation. And there's always tension around this whole idea. How do you reconcile something that was never correct in the first place? And how do you deal with the fact that faith and Christianity has been complicit with the issue of racism and slavery, slaveholder religion? So those conversations were happening. And then Tom was courageous enough to talk to his white peers in the evangelical church, mainly about racial equity, and was able to, by the trust he built with them, was able to forge these conversations. And then essentially he came to me and said, would you want to join me in this, come in the room with me? And, you know, my first reaction, like, oh, here we go. I don't want to go. And Tom will tell you, I'm like, man, I'm 50 something years old. You know, I know what it's like to be in a place that really doesn't care about the black experience in America. They don't want to hear that. It's, you know, you had your black president, you know, you got your entertainers and athletes, you know, what's the problem? You know, you got access, we let you in our schools. And so, but you know, it was a divine connection, for sure. Based on some other things that would happen in my life, that's a longer story than I should take on this podcast. But it was essentially through that re-meeting at my church. And then we say, okay, let's go talk to some more people, people who have power and influence. And they were we were fortunate enough to get an audience. And we just started continuing to do that. And then we landed on, well, we can't just teach. We need to act. And this fund was one way to act.
I love that. Tom, that took a lot of faith and courage, like, because for those who are have the audio experience, Tom does have no melanin in his skin whatsoever. So for him to go into, I'm assuming the predominantly black church, and say, hey, I need you to come on this mission with me. Like, what was that like for you? And then the conversation, I can only imagine. What words did you say to get this man to come on this journey with you?
Well, Keith mentioned our mutual friend, and that was Ernest Smith, who in the 90s, I was involved with Promise Keepers. He and I were in leadership. And so my first experience in, you know, black church was to go visiting churches. So it wasn't being in the black space as much, but when I was in dire straits, really, I had convinced like 20 of the pastors at this mega church to do this racial equity 4 session that I had worked through twice with just, you know, my friends, not any theologians. And then I was actually in the 4th week of the material, and I was supposed to talk about the theology, and I had literally had just one verse. So I was really in dire straits. And, you know, so Keith had been recommended to me by Ernest, actually his wife, Cameron, and I just hadn't made the connection with him yet. And there he is at the church. I was going to this talk on racial reconciliation, which really fit with me, because Promise Keepers, that was what they were all about, but prejudice and segregated spaces. But even I knew at the time, 6 years ago, that conversation was dated. And, you know, while white churches were still using that terminology, I realized it was long past. So what did startle me, though, when I asked Keith is like, will you help me do this? He said, you know, basically on the condition that it not be transactional, on the condition that we have a relationship and that this wasn't just going to be, you know, something that we did without building a relationship. And that was eye-opening and made me pause. And then, the next thing he said, quite frankly, is that you know, a lot of times there's no trust, and that he didn't know me enough to trust me. Mm-hmm. And again, I've had relationships across the color line, but no one ever had voiced that. And I think that was very eye-opening for me to understand kind of what was at stake here, and that this wasn't just, you know, putting together a Bible study with somebody, and mm-hmm. there was a lot more at stake.
Now, so, I love that.
Give me pause. Yeah.
And I think those are very key, really good key foundations to any type of long-term transformational relationship that you have, is building that foundation of communication and trust. And looks like something that you were able to work on, manifest, and still continuously build as I see you guys engage with each other. Now, another thing that you had mentioned is that, you know, that faith-based, when you say faith-based is how you kind of built this venture, what does that mean to the both of you? Like, what is it? What are those faith-based principles? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'll let Keith talk about the principles, but the motivation for me, I'd been on the mission field just out of college, and I have participated in the evangelical church 100%. I've been all in. I mean, donated a bunch of money, my time, 2 years of my life. It was the focus of my life. And when Promise Keepers came along, I did attach myself to the idea of doing the racial reconciliation. And I learned a lot in that time. And then I sort of saw it just go away. Right. I mean, that concern by the church to care about the conversation just dissipated. I think men's movements went on towards, you know, wild at heart and like getting around a campfire and banging drums almost. It you know, that idea of being in having a life of integrity and really challenging some of the big justice related conversations had just disappeared. So fast forward to like 2013, or I mean, it was my conversation with my white peers all that time. Whenever I had a chance, I would say, well, I learned a lot from Ernest during this time when he explained to me what it was like to be African-American in a white world. And, you know, it'd be very beneficial for you to ask someone that and bridge that conversation and learn. But hardly anyone ever took me up on that. I had one guy do it one time. He came back with an amazing story, but most didn't care to. But then, you know, all of a sudden our church in like 2015 was starting to talk about, maybe it was 2015 or so, they were starting to, the topic was coming up on the surface again, but it was the same old conversation from the 90s. It was like racial reconciliation. Let's talk about racial reconciliation again. But then it was also cloaked in the idea of like, let's, you know, Jesus is really all we need to fix this problem. And if we're just better Christ followers, everything will, you know, heal itself. And there's really no need to look back at the history. We just need to call on the unity card and call for unity in Christ and all of our. And that really rubbed me the wrong way. I mean, I was learning about the history of racial equity and learning about, you know, what happened after the 13th Amendment, and I had all this historical context of what really happened and what the real cause of the wealth divide and racism. So I really wanted to lean into sort of lead or encourage my white evangelicals friends to like, let's really lean into this conversation and get it right this time. Not like we did in the 90s where we just kind of sugarcoated it. So that's where I need to keep though, because I had the racial equity content and the racism content. And I had a, you know, when you realize that racism is not a biblical construct, you kind of, you can't proof text it. There's no 10th commandment or 11th commandment says, you know, don't be racist, you know. So you've got to figure out how to use a gospel train of thought or methodology to bring it forward. So
yeah.
That's where Keith entered the picture.
Okay.
Well, I mean, if you look at the history of wealth building in the capitalistic system, mm-hmm. there's this idea that we can go from rags to riches, you just need to work hard. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty strong motivation. I mean, growing up, we knew education was important. So you figure, I get my education, my four-year degree. And then you realize you wake up at some point, we have to wake up and say, well, it's not, you know, wealth, the wealth gap has been a history of affirmative action for whites. And mm-hmm. that can just become more just incredibly depressing. And so you could go to church and say, okay, God, I'm a believer in the prosperity gospel. I'm just going to believe that, you know, you're going to just make me a millionaire. And if I just have faith and work hard. And so I went through kind of a journey in the 90s and the 2000, right into the early 2000s. I was like, wait a minute. Okay. I'm on the wrong path here. This vision of faith is going to make me a millionaire. That ain't sitting right with my spirit, because I'm walking out of my church and I'm looking at a community that is in despair. And we go inside and it's like, oh, we don't care about anybody from doing the week, really. And we can do charity all day long. Dr. King said philanthropy is commendable, but it must not stop the philanthropist from overlooking the economic injustices that make it necessary. Mm-hmm. Right. So when you start to examine that a little bit more and you start to realize, and this is a tough equation, because Tom and I, we've spent a lot of time, more than I would have imagined when I said, hey, if we're going to do this, it can't be transactional. But you think about a story like John Merrick and Washington Duke, for example, and here in North Carolina. You know, Merrick had all these barbershops. He had other business interests. He would eventually, you know, start the largest insurance company, black insurance company in America. And they would grow that company to, you know, tremendous size. It's a legacy story. Mm-hmm. And there's a part of the story where, you know, Washington Duke was very generous towards, we don't know how generous, but he said, hey, I want, you know, as long as y'all stay on your side, pretty much. It wasn't really like we're going to really integrate, but we're going to say, we think that's important to empower your people. Right. And then at some point, economic development comes in and destroys the Haiti community. You create greater class divisions in the black community, and on and on and on. And when you look at it, it's like really depressing. Mm-hmm. And we know about this in other cities as well. But, you know, we could sit back and just mourn. We have to mourn that. We lament it. But then we do have to take action. And quite frankly, the action needs to be taken by more people, more white folks who are wealthy and who have the means to actually address these inequities. And it's a really hard equation, Terrell, because, you know, you look back on that legacy period and you say to yourself, man, how good it was when we were the proprietors of our own resources in our own community, and the black dollar stayed in our community. Mm-hmm. Our educational systems were kind of full circle between, you know, those who were in the collegiate space and those who were trades. You know, you have the whole dynamic between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois about how can we really coalesce the black experience in America using our head and our hands. And it's just a rugged, it's a tough space. And, you know, you're out in San Diego, whole nother kind of scenario there, right? We're here in the deep South, and, you know, entrepreneurs here, you know, there's kind of this hurrah of, oh, this is a great place to be an entrepreneur. But if there's nobody intentionally saying, we're coming after you, we're coming for you with capital access networks. So that was kind of our mindset. Now, the faith part of it was, well, I believe that before Dr. King was assassinated, he was talking about a guaranteed minimum income. You know, there was other kind of like, we got to go to the second level of achieving the dream in America, right? We got a seat on the bus. I can sit at the coffee table. I can't own none of that, but I can at least have my dignity and sit and be, and not have to, you know, that was such a rugged time to even get to that point. And he said it back then. He said, when he wrote the letter from Birmingham jail, you know, he was like, look, I'm surprised my clergy friends, you white ones, don't understand what's going on here. If you would be more upset about the poverty and the ghettoization of our people, and less concerned about like, oh, in time it's going to come, because time, it never comes in time. You know, those in power need to work towards. So when Tom came along with this gesture of, again, not from a charity mindset, he's like, man, we got some wealth that we can do some things. You know, we can put some money in some black founders and go to work and let's do it. And it's hard and it's challenging, but that's what life, I think, one way to pursue life.
Yeah. And it is challenging. And I think it comes from the difference between, you know, the growth mindset, and then there's also, you know, because there's a lot to unpack there in those who may have that disparity mindset of like, oh, there's only so much resources, right? So if I give you some of this, I am going to lose. Like, by giving away this, I lose something, which is not necessarily the case. Like, there's enough. There is enough for everybody to be successful. There's enough abundance for the it's not just this one pie and everybody gets a second. There's plenty of pies to for everybody to have their own pie. And we all be successful. And I think it has a little bit to do with embracing that mindset with some faith, some curiosity, some best practices so people can see it done. And it's like, oh, wait, so that doesn't mean I have to give up. Like, I could just put in, and then everybody receives some wealth from this. And hopefully, I think when people see what you are putting together and doing, they it gets to be a model that could be replicated. I was like, look what they're doing down in North Carolina. And now if they could do this in North Carolina, I'm pretty sure we can do that over here in San Diego, right? I'm pretty sure we can do this over here in Virginia, New York, Delaware, wherever people are situated.
Yeah.
So I think that's what it'll take. I'm curious though, Thomas, what, you know, because I think anytime people resist anything, it's because of that fear, right? The fear of the unknown, right? So what helped you kind of lean into that fear, even though you didn't know what the outcome was going to be, but it helped you gain a different perspective and understanding, right? What helped you to be more comfortable in leaning in?
Well, I'm entrepreneurial by nature. So I think a lot of people think like venture funds are, you know, something other than what they really are. They're really a kind of startup. Usually a venture fund is started by people that were in the private equity business. Maybe they work for Morgan Stanley or someone like that, and they've done it all their lives. And they said, I can do this on my own. I can create my own fund. And they come to it with years of experience, and they start their own shop. You know, I've done that in software. I never expected to be in this space. I contributed to the entrepreneurial community here in North Carolina in a pretty big way. I certainly pulled more than my share in the 80s and 90s. I know what a good environmental entrepreneurial ecosystem looks like. And one of the things I was first thinking, like, once I guess I got to the point where I said, this is an economic thing. This is a wealth gap. What can we do to change that? Poverty is not because of moral failure. Poverty is because African Americans have been disinherited from what we as white people have inherited. I mean, Keith mentioned, you know, affirmative action for white people. When I saw that we had, you know, 400 years of affirmative action and every kind of crazy thing like, you know, Homestead Act, et cetera, all down the line, GI Bill, FHA, et cetera, really started to see, you know, poverty in the slums are a result of withholding flourishing. So I pretty well came to the idea, like, what could we do to move money across the racial wealth gap as a solution? In terms of being afraid, I am kind of my own person. I don't, you know, being an entrepreneur, it's like, what's the worst thing that could go wrong, right? I mean, I really look at it like that. I mean, even if we move personally, it's $1 million for me, but that over 5 years, and that sounds like an awful lot. It's probably, you know, 25% of my wealth, but what is the worst that could happen? I just have to keep working a little longer. So, or, you know, in the first year of the fund, we hadn't raised what we needed. We'd gotten to like $1 million and a bit of change. You know, we needed, we weren't sustainable, you know? So, we would have had to figure out how to, you know, rustle up some money to pay our salaries. I don't have a fear of approval. I mean, approval doesn't mean that much to me. So, I mean, I'm not worried about what my white peers think about me. So I'm kind of a, what's the word? Contrarian in a lot of ways.
I love it.
And I kind of like, you know, Keith starts telling me that you're an abolitionist. That's what he was saying to me, stuff like that. What? Okay, so you're calling me to be an abolitionist and free up some money. We're going to go down and liberate some dollars. So, you know, give Keith credit to encouraging me in any time I might have had some doubts. But
hey, Keith encourages me too. Like, just hear his story, him being on this episode is encouraging to me. Like, you have me out here thinking, like, all right, this is brilliant. How could I start a fund like this in my town? Like, I need to know, like, how are people receiving it? How are you, do you go to a bank? Like, what does this look like? Give me the ins and outs. What does this look like?
We did it through the people that would consider themselves angel investors. So in the world of entrepreneurship, if you make it, and you know, you sell your company, you're 40, 50, 60 years old, you're looking around for what to do because you don't have anything to do after you sold your company. You start to think, well, I'll invest in people that look like me and help them and enjoy the journey with them. That's what an angel investor is. And so I know that network a bit. So we reached out to people like that. And when we created the fund, as we were, you know, exploring what our pitch deck would look like, we got a lot of advice. People would say, you should start a not-for-profit. But we stuck with this is not philanthropy or charity. These are legitimate companies. You just can't see them. They need capital, and we're going to make money doing this. We were faithful to tell everyone in our pitch deck that the reason was the racial equity conversation. So we had a slide in our deck that spelled out, you know, historic results of slavery, not getting 40 acres and a mule, getting instead incarceration and sharecropping, not getting the FHA, not getting the GI Bill, et cetera, you know, 8 bullets. So worst case, we figured at least, you know, we were sitting in a lot of boardrooms telling a lot of rich white people something that they were never going to get because they weren't going to go to a racial equity seminar. So we were doing that.
That must have shocked a few people. I can only imagine like what those conversations were like once you left them.
There were some interesting ones. You know, we literally had this angel investor say that venture capitalists could not possibly be racist because the lure of money would overtake any internal bias that they might have. And that if they saw a good deal from a black entrepreneur, the love of money would overcome any bias that they had.
If that were true. If only that were true.
And therefore, racism does not exist in the venture world. Oh, dear.
Like, yeah, go ahead, Keith.
No, I was going to say raising money is raising money, right? I mean, communicating, people got to believe, they got to look in the eye and believe that you're going to do, you know, you're going to execute on your thesis, you're going to do the work. And we built trust across a number of sectors, but we didn't have a track record. So that in and of itself was a big step, right? Mm-hmm. And Tom is running a software company. I'm running my own personal consulting, higher educational consulting work, still doing contracts that way. I recently had someone say, well, if you were really all in, and I'm like, that's interesting you say all in for me as an African-American man, because you know, the risk level for me are so much higher, right? If this fails, it is a big deal. So I need multiple streams of being able to manage my own interest and my own value and worth. And that's a conversation that's worth having. But for those who really want to have that kind of conversation, right? And it's just not often where you get a person who we often say raced as white just to try to make it not so pejorative. Because you know it's a construct, but the reality is it's refreshing when you have someone who's raced as white who kind of says, okay, help, I'm not going anywhere. I want to understand, and I'm not just responding because there's another public outrage. They keep showing up and they're asking the questions. How can I get behind what you're doing? Tell me what you need, and not from that you're needy either. That's the other thing. It's like I don't need any more relations. We're coachable. To a degree, again, I have to throw that in there. I'm 50, approaching 54. Tom's run his company for 30 years. You know, we're on the side now. We want to do the coaching. You know, we want, but starting a fund, we needed to create an advisory team. We have quarterly meetings with them, a talented group of people, tremendous experience. We have one of the best attorneys in the country in this space. And so I love being a part of teams as well. And I just believe that, call it naive or crazy, I still think it's worth pursuing integrated spaces. And again, some days it's maybe more days than not. I'm like, why are we still trying to do this? That's why, you know, if I go back and say, should I have gone to the HBCU and played football there instead of at Duke? You know, it becomes a question, right? So I'm like, yeah, how much did I miss out on? How much did I lose? How much formation did I not experience now that I know what that brings to our community, right? So these are constant sort of tensions we live in. Like, I got to show up in spaces, and I often use the language that was not built for me, but I got to show up like I belong and I'm looking to own something, right?
Yeah.
I'm not just looking to be another piece of furniture that's a different color, that's only utilitarian, you know, and being exploited and being used because it's just there, right? No, I want to feel like I'm really a part of something where I'm an owner and a valuable contributor. Yeah. And I think that's what DE&I is doing more now. You know, it's that push to say, okay, equality is important, but it's not the end game. Diversity is important. And that's what we started 30 years ago with the question of diversity. But it can't be the end game. We got to talk about equity, inclusion, belonging. Now there's a whole kind of range of, like, how are we going to keep good people? And so that's something that we enjoy continually talking about.
Yeah. And I find that as I'm in these different spaces too, you know, everything that you had mentioned, like, you know, I think like as if I belong there, and which takes a level of, I guess, confidence, for lack of better words, in yourself and your abilities. And then also another thing that has helped me be successful is just having that curiosity to understand the individuals in that environment, but curiosity not by suspending all judgment, and a curiosity like from a willingness to learn, like, even though I may not agree, but it usually breaks down, and then we can have a more, I guess, heartfelt and rich discussion about, help me understand what do you mean by that, and okay, and wanting to learn more, and then they feel more comfortable with stating the reason why they feel strongly about whatever it is they feel strongly about. Now, the question I have is about because the VC world, and my take on this could be wrong. When I look at the VC world, it's mainly white, it's mainly upper class, and they have a certain bias because of we all have biases, but going back to what you were saying earlier, like, VCs usually invest by the teams. Some do. It's not just about the money. It's about the team and the faith in the team to bring that vision forward, right? So if I see a white person who has multiple streams of income and has been successful with them, I tend to look at that person. Okay, he's done it before. He could bring it forward. But if I see the black man who has multiple streams of income and has this track record, it's like, I don't know if he's all in. there's where that bias kicked in. So, you know, at some point how do we start to integrate and educate and transform, you know, so we can have that pause on, like, oh, wait, you know, how that bias may have filtered the information that I'm using to make the decision to invest, not invest towards a fund or a community. Like, what is it that, I guess, you try to do to help refilter that lens?
Yeah, that's really important. Just recently, we really began to think about the mind of the white investor and how to either... There's a term that we ran into recently, like in the conversation of race, you know, are you calling people out or are you calling people in? You know, it's easy to call them out, right? And, you know, get up on your soapbox, and I'm pretty good at that. So, but how do you call them in? and still communicate the message, important message, and move the needles in a way that they're responsive to it. And there's so much material in this one space because there's easily 10 things. I mean, our white culture is so, the concept of meritocracy is so deep in our being. Meritocracy, bootstrapping, we don't see our own privilege. And we don't see the economic reality of the racial wealth gap. So a VC is going to expect, for instance, you have friends and family money. Mm-hmm. They have no idea about they do not apply the concept of the racial wealth gap to your particular situation if you're a Black founder. They just look at it and say, they ding you because you don't have friends and family money. They don't know that, half of your network has less than $10,000 to their name. The other half has more than 10. They pattern match. They say, half of my friends and family have more than $200,000. So why don't you, mm-hmm. Just like you said, Terrell, they expect, well, it's funny, like what you say, right? If you're hustling, if you have more than one job, you're not all in, right? So they expect you to be all in on something, but what's supporting you there? There's a number of these. If I can just pause, I know you can stop this thing because this is something that's really been on our mind. Here's one. The idea of entrepreneurship really has changed. This is something that's been very dramatic to me because I was really in it 30 years ago, and now I'm coming back to it. When I was an entrepreneur in the 80s and 90s, there was no serial entrepreneur. That concept hadn't even been invented yet. Mm-hmm. Today's entrepreneur is you go to college, you enroll in an entrepreneurship program, you come out of college, university, and you become a serial entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. You get funded. If you fail, the white VC says, you learned from your failures. I will invest in you again. It's a benefit to fail because you've learned. You get 7 swings at a bat. This is the new culture of entrepreneurship. So, but will they apply that? Will the white VC apply that same understanding to a Black founder? And that's what we're asking. Like, mm-hmm. will you invest in one Black founder? Mm-hmm. And if he fails, will you invest in another? Or will you reinvest in him again? Or will you invest in 10? Because we all know white VCs, we believe that you got to invest in 10 founders before you get a successful one. Mm-hmm. But will you apply that same measurement to investing in Black founders? I think that if we really think about it, we're trying to figure out how to call the white angel investor to really think about that. I think they know the answer is one and I'd be done, really. I mean, I gave that a shot. It didn't work. Mm. I've learned. I'm not going to invest. So the question is, should we're educating the people in our network on that, on those understandings as best we can. I guess the question is the Black founder, is that part of the conversation for them? Like when Keith came to me and said, I don't trust you, that was a wake-up call for me. That had never been put to me that way. Mm-hmm. What if Black founders say to white VCs, I don't trust you? Will you invest in me again if I fail? Will you invest in 9 other founders after me? Those are some, can I trust you? That's a heavy ask. I recognize that's a super heavy lift to ask a Black founder to enter that dialogue with a VC.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's trust on both ends, just trust built on both ends mm-hmm. of this conversation. Because if we look at what's happened since George Floyd, right, we've seen dozens of VCs, corporations do the Black Lives Matter pledge. Yeah. Like, we're going to go and invest in Black communities. We're going to go invest in Black businesses. We're going to do this. And one thing that I've been talking to my staff about is like, remember we saw that. I wonder what they've been doing since then. And then how have they been doing? Do they need support on this? As a Black man trying to help the Black community, that was a big That's a big commitment. Like, if I was to do that commitment, I'd be scared. Like, oh, how am I going to do this? And I'm from the community, so I wonder how they doing it. They're not from the community, yeah. Right? Yeah. And so, you know, we talked about doing this campaign about run the receipts, where we would have ask all of them, okay, what have you doing? Let's share some best practices. What have you learned along the way? And if you're not doing it, it's okay. No judgment here. Let's see how we can build community to help support you. Let's get with Thomas and Keith, who has a fund over here that could use some support. And we have a bunch of people that we can connect you with that could really, if we work together, we can move the needle on some things. Our podcast is here to highlight those different companies that could use your support. If you want to invest or if you want to just collaborate, let's see how we can bridge that gap together. It takes some trust on both ends, right? Both can be true, because I think after we all seen those pledges, you know, and you have to keep in mind that, you know, Black people have a very fickle relationship with the systems to be that were not built for us, right? So we understand, like, oh, okay, all right. Am I going to trust blindly again, or am I going to come in this with some reservations? I don't know if it's like that for you, Keith, when you enter the room, when you have to talk to these VCs and you're looking around and you know the space isn't meant for you, but how much trust and of yourself do you bear so that you can still be the best version of yourself to help move the needle to change? And yeah. How do you do that dancing act?
Yeah, it's a negotiation. You know, when I keep going back to King, because I think about the movement leaders, and like, they knew that there was a dream, there was an aspiration that this country, first of all, had the money. I mean, you know, back then it was like, I think he even talked to one of the economic advisors. He's like, how much would it take to, you know, to kind of close the wealth gap? He's like, yeah, a few trillion. He's like, oh yeah, we got that. Cause you know, we put people on the moon, you know, we just take a slither of the military budget, but we're so hardened on our ideologies around what makes us powerful as a nation. And it's a shame that we have not addressed the racial disparity and the economic. So there are some days when I realize that, We fight this battle of the mythology and what do we want for our society. And I think, you know, the sobering reality is that King and the movement leaders, there was equal pushback in our community for what power, how we could best coalesce our power and our resources. And I really come to more and more respect the Stokely Carmichaels and the Malcolm X and the understanding that, you know, we're probably better off focusing on taking care of our own. And I've got friends who have committed to that. They're like, we will welcome white altruistic interests, but ultimately we're going to be pretty hard gatekeepers around that. You just can't do that with venture. You know, you can't, you know, that doesn't, you essentially can't. And so you're either going to participate or not. We'll see how this journey runs for Tom and I. I mean, again, it'll be some years before true success is sort of revealed for our fund per se. I mean, we're grateful that some of our companies are in up rounds, but it's a long game. So 7 to 10 years, right? This is not a get rich quick kind of thing. And so we're trying to stay in the moment, enjoy the journey, help our entrepreneurs, make connections, even those we don't invest in. I spend 10 hours a week. I open up my calendar for 30-minute phone appointments with founders. I don't care where they are. And they just need to talk to someone. And it's refreshing when they say, oh, we got a brother on this side who is not in it just for himself. I mean, I'm past that point of life where it's like, it's about all about me. I've got two kids in college, one about to graduate in 2 weeks. So my paycheck's going to go up even a little bit more because, you know, I won't have that bit of fee coming off. But in all seriousness, you know this, Terrell, our parents really doubled down because they believe that if you got your education, and of course for them, it was like, well, good paying job and benefits and just coast it on till you get your watch at the end. And I'm like, how can we make the community better at the same? How can we grow the wealth and be more than just lifestyle? I mean, that's wonderful. I don't like to say the word just a lot of times because it usually takes away. Because we know small business in America is important. But we decided we choose the high growth type of companies because we want more activity in that space. And fortunately, ecosystems around the country are starting to galvanize around high growth African-American founders. And that's encouraging to know that's happening.
Yeah, it is. And I'm seeing it happening all across the country. So I'm excited to see what happens in the future for the growth of not only your company, but others who are like you. I mean, what's some advice you would give to people who are inspired by what you're doing and want to get it started in their own town or city, or even venture capitalists who have sat on the edge of curiosity and wanting to do what you all are doing, but haven't made the leap or jump yet? What's some advice you would give to those folks?
Well, I'll just quickly say it's a lot. I mean, we're non-traditional. We didn't come, when I woke up 5 years ago, when I went back to divinity school, I didn't imagine this part of my life. So you got to be learned. You got to be a voracious learner. I think, like you said, Terrell, you know, the level of curiosity, you got to be able to go places outside your comfort zone, talk to people. Fear is not, it's a healthy emotion. So some of that needs to be there to motivate you, and you need a good team or a good partner. I think there are some we've met some people that are kind of wonder women and wonder men, but at some point you got to wear so many hats, you can't wear them all that well. You're going to have to figure out how to get people into your team. And that's a bias for me because I've grown up and playing on teams. I know what it looks like to have a lot of different strengths and capacities that come and coalesce around a mission. Yeah, curiosity, team, getting out of the comfort zone, those are all kind of qualities that I think are critical to be resilient and even when things are changing so rapidly, so fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree about team. A lot of VCs look at that. They look for teams of people that maybe even worked together in a previous job and then went out and started something new. I think doing your research, I mean, we didn't just build another wheel because we didn't reinvent the wheel, so to speak. We did spend a lot of time finding out what was already there, who had done what, who was doing what. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were already, when we started, there were already 40 funds that we knew of that were either run by African-American private equity managers or who were investing in African-Americans. Most of them were Black funds investing in African-American founders. We felt like this was not like cutting edge. There were already enough firms that had been in it long enough that this wasn't totally new. But then we took the attitude of joining, not fixing. I mean, as much as we're doing whatever we're doing, we really see ourselves as joining a movement and being part of a movement. And we know, you know, we're a small fund, all things considered. There are a lot bigger funds out there. But our $3.5 million is what it is. And it's 30 white LPs that are moving their money in this space. And they have pretty good understanding of why we're doing it. And they're excited about being part of it.
I'm excited just to get this episode out to the people so they can learn more about you. Let's end it off like this. What does the future look like, or what are your hopes and dreams for the future if this is successful in the next 5 years? And then tell the people where they can find you and how they could become a part of this journey.
Well, my hope and dream is that it won't just be, you know, Resilient Ventures, that we hope to have impact on all the angel investors and all the VCs that we meet in the syndicate meeting, and that their awareness is raised, and whether or not they start a fund or not, they will know, they will bring that back either to their company, or it'll change their investing practices, and at the same time, there should be there's small VC funds all over the country. Any city the size, you know, San Diego's got to have 30 funds. I bet if you'd like, just, I mean, there's 20 in Durham or something like that. You know, this, a city, wow, a city this size is going to have, you know, they're small, independent. They're not Morningstar or something like that or whatever, but there's people running funds and they're not, they don't have the thesis that we do, but I would hope that any city the size of Durham or larger would have a fund of their own that would be investing in African-American founders or black and brown or whatever combination you want to say. And for the world to see, you know, that it's a matter of justice, that the racial wealth gap did not come from anything but being disinherited from financial flourishing at every step of the way, whether it was they didn't get 40 acres and a mule like the white indentured servants got, or they didn't get FHA or GI Bill. I mean, I would hope this in 5 years that the general populace would understand that the wealth gap was created by our economic policies.
Well, Tom, I hope so, too. You keep talking that talk and hopefully they'll start walking that walk. Keith, what are your dreams and hopes for the future? And then if you could close us out by telling us where the people can find you and connect with you.
Yeah, well, we certainly want our companies to be successful. We have 11 companies, two in Atlanta, one in Detroit, one in Chicago, five here in the Carolinas. And you can go to our website, www.resilient-ventures.com. You'll see our portfolio companies listed there, and you'll see our team, and you'll see our resource page, where we're fortunate to be on shows like yours, because we want folks to know that we are in this work and we believe that this is one way to address the wealth gap. There has to be many other solutions as well. And we're both on LinkedIn, Keith Daniel 88 on LinkedIn. You can find me at Duke University and some of the teaching roles there. We have a research project that we're running at the university, so still in the high academic space. And then our local community here in Durham, Provident 1898, we'll give a shout out to them as a place dedicated to black and brown creators and innovators and entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of other places I could name as well. But yeah, you come to Durham, come check us out. We're proud of what we call Durhamites. Lots to uplift about this community, while at the same time trying to address the very real concerns in our community that affect all of us. And so we're hoping to bring more peace, justice, and love to the world. And we still can be, we believe we can still do that and make significant money for our investors and ourselves. And we're unashamed about that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, thank you again, Terrell, for the privilege of being on.
I have the privilege and the honor of meeting the just great individuals like yourself. I'm often using this as the time for me to learn, soak up more knowledge, and then just share with the world. In my head, I'm already contemplating how I can get you guys back for a master class or something like that. I don't know what that looks like, but we'll stay in touch with each other.
Fly us out to San Diego. We'll come at the drop of a hat.
Are you sure you want this sunny weather and palm trees?
Yeah, we like to cycle a lot. I'd love to get, we cycled in Montana in July. We need to get a little further west, you know, we'd be ready to come.
All right, we'll see how we're going to make that happen. But thank you both again for your time, your knowledge, and just your passion, your spirit, and everything that you're doing. I can't wait to have a reunion one of these days just to see how far you've come. And hopefully we can inspire some more people who want to go on this journey with you. So thank you, Keith and Thomas. Appreciate you so much. This has been another episode of Rise Urban Nation. For those of you who are driving, if there's still a drive time to work, or you're busy, you're multitasking, you were able to write any of that down, I'm going to get all of their information and put it in the show notes for you. So don't worry. We'll have everything that so you can connect with these two gentlemen. And thank you again.
Thank you so much, Terrell.
Both of you.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. Appreciate you. Appreciate you, Terrell. Take care, brother.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Rise Urban Nation.
Thank you for taking the journey.
Be sure to like, comment, and smash that subscribe button. And stay connected with Terrell on and off the show. Follow at Rise Urban Nation on all platforms.
Do what you love. Love what you do. Don't chase the money. Let the money chase you.